Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Damani Partridge, who is the author of the book, Blackness as a Universal Claim, Holocaust Heritage, Non-Citizen Futures, and Black Power in Berlin, published by the University of California Press. Dr. Partridge, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about your book. And so you are the author of the previous book, Hypersexuality and Headscarves, Race, Sex, and Citizenship in the New Germany. And that was published by Indiana University Press. And in this book that we're going to talk about today, which of course is Blackness as a Universal Claim, it also examines race and cultural politics in Germany. And so you have this long history of doing this kind of research in this context. And I wanted to just begin by way of an introduction for you to ask how you came to study, you know, Germany anthropology and how you came to write the book Blackness as a Universal Claim.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I guess Germany, I was a middle school student, you know, in Ithaca, actually. And German was just the best teacher, so I decided to take German. And then in high school, I had a friend who was going to an exchange program. My mom said, oh, you should do that too. So I applied for Rotary Exchange, and that was 1989, 90. So that was the year the wall fell. I didn't know that was going to happen, obviously. But so I ended up in Germany as a Rotary Exchange student, and I lived with three families. One was a Turkish-German family that were two doctors. It was kind of a middle-class family, a lawyer and a secretary. And then I lived on a dairy farm. And what struck me about that experience is that even though I was African-American, I didn't feel the same kind of like exclusions or expectations or lack of expectations about Blackness that I had felt in the U.S. But there was a lot of animosity against Turkish people. There was graffiti all over that said, Turks, get out. And like even my classmates would yell at people in the street saying, you know, go home or get out of the country. And then when I lived with the Turkish German family, they also talked about those kind of experiences. So it was really, to me, interesting to see this kind of racism or racial exclusion from the perspective of someone who weren't, you know, explicitly or visually Black. But I could identify with that. And yet I was seen as something else. It seemed like I was kind of exceptional in some way because I didn't have the kind of same kind of experience I was having in the U.S. So then that was high school, and then I went to college, and then I applied for Fulbright and came back to Germany in 1995. And at that point, I lived with an East German family who had belonged to the party, actually, the East German, the Socialist Party in East Germany. But this is after the fall of the wall. And then again, they talked about their feelings of exclusion after the wall because their experience was no longer valued, you know, even though they had this kind of responsibility before. And so we really connected over that, even though, again, it wasn't Blackness in the way that I'd experienced it, but there was this kind of not being at the center of the society, even though they once were. And so that year I applied, I was deciding, as an undergrad, I was a major in political science and music. And I went to Germany then as a Fulbright scholar to do a project on the experience of Black Germans after the fall of the wall and thinking about the relationship between East and West. Like how did they come together to think about Blackness after the fall of the wall as Black Germans? And then I decided then that to apply to graduate school in anthropology at Berkeley. And then that began this beginning of this project of who's German, who's Germany, whose futures. And then that gradually shifted into thinking about the category of what I call non-citizens in my first book, and thinking about what kinds of, how does one become a non-citizen, who experienced freedom after the fall of the wall. Like the fall of the wall was supposed to be this moment of massive global celebration about what Franz Fukuyama called the end of history, which I mean, now no one says that anymore, but there was supposed to be like this, like finally like this liberal democracy concept had won and everyone was free. But then at the same time, people of color, Turkish Germans, Arab Germans, lots of other people were experiencing massive violence. There were like massive neo-Nazi attacks. There was attacks in Vietnamese homes of former Vietnamese labor migrants in East Germany. And so I thought that I needed to expand this category to think about non-citizens more broadly. And so I started analyzing then what I called in that book exclusionary incorporation, that people were accepted in the society, but then they weren't accepted fully, or they had to, that book is called Hypersexual Headscarf. So they had to either live up to these expectations of hypersexuality, and the headscarf seemed to be blocking that. So then that was also a problem for the mainstream society. So I was analyzing that process in the first book. In this book, I wanted to think about blackness as a universal claim. I wanted to think about, well, what does one do amidst those kinds of exclusions? How can one organize oneself to think about a different kind of future? And how does that happen collectively? And for this, and part of understanding how that happens, I went to a theater performance and I saw this theater called Theater X in Berlin. And I saw that as a space in which these practices of creating a different kind of possibility were being worked out, you know, kind of in everyday life.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, that answer. And so the book, I wanted to start, I guess, with your idea, with the idea that organizes the book, which is, you know, blackness as a universal claim. And you examine and theorize how immigrants in Germany leverage blackness to make these claims and express their experiences with racism. And I thought, you know, this is interesting for many reasons. One of them is because we might think about, you know, whiteness is usually what stands in for the universal. But so you offer us this other, you know, idea of universality. And so I wondered just if you could talk about then this idea of blackness as a universal claim.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You're right. Like whiteness, yeah, that's right. Whiteness stands in as a universal, but it doesn't call itself out as white though. So then it's like very confusing for someone and harmful, you know, potentially for someone who thinks that they can access that universal as someone who's not white or someone who, so then for me to think about, not necessarily to say that blackness, I mean, it's not clear that blackness is universal necessarily, but what was clear to me is that people are seeing blackness as a possibility for political articulation. Following that was helpful for me because not only for me, but hopefully for other people as well, to think about what kind of political claims one can make about the future, about the world, if one doesn't assume that this liberal democratic, you know, version, you know, is going to make them free, you know, like, so then to think from that position of blackness, I think comes with kinds of responsibility as well. In this project, I observe people making claims to blackness in the theater, like by thinking about, in Berlin, I think in other places as well, you know, Muhammad Ali is something that like lots of people wear, even whether or not they're black, as a kind of, as a symbol of liberation. In the theater, they had a little picket sign with Malcolm X. They worked out and practiced through like the politics of Angela Davis. And then they went further to think about the history of slavery and thinking about from that, if one begins to think about freedom from the position of the actual slave, which is, I mean, could be problematic, but at least it doesn't begin with like an assumption, like it begins with the actual slave as opposed to like, Susan Buck Morris talks about the metaphor of the slave in the, you know, like in the theories of Locke, Rousseau and other Enlightenment theorists. But if one thinks of the position from the actual slave and the effects of slavery, now, then the demands on what it would mean to be free would be quite different. And I think that is the, for me, that if one is to think about any kind, any form of freedom that, that could be universal, it would have to begin from that kind of position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I like that succinct description that you give of that idea. And then, because in the book, it's, you divide the book into thirds, and the beginning of the third, you know, you, the beginning of the book, you locate Blackness as this occupation with post-World War II African-American soldiers in Germany. And so, you know, it kind of answers this question, I guess, of like, well, where do these ideas, where's one locus of where these ideas about Blackness come from? And on page 27, I'm going to quote you, because you write, "The figure of the Black American soldier allowed German access to America, American capital, and Black possibility." And I wondered if you could just begin by talking about this idea of occupying Blackness, because that was one of your main ideas in the first part of the book. And, you know, how did this inform imaginations in Germany?
Yeah, thank you. I think, like, this idea of occupying Blackness is both, it's both actually happening, but it's also a kind of theoretical or imagined kind of possibility, or imagined reality, in the sense that Blackness is there in the society, like in the cultural life of the society, you know, through music, through dance, through, and that's the one that's, that some people say, well, that's kind of American imperialism, but I'm not focusing on that aspect. I'm not focusing on what comes in spite of the imperialism, right? So that when the Americans occupied after the Second World War, when they occupied Germany, also it's important to think that it's not just America occupying Germany, but it's also Black troops, Blackness, you know, Black people occupying Germany. And what difference does that make to thinking about Blackness, to thinking about freedom, to thinking about the future? And I think that in Germany made a lot of difference in the sense that a lot of the Germans who had been defeated could identify with the Black soldiers in a way that they couldn't identify the white soldiers, because they also saw those as people who were being oppressed, you know, because they knew about the civil rights movement, about Jim Crow in the South. And then there were kind of relationships, you know, where Black troops would give these defeated Germans, like, you know, things to eat and give them. They were, like, impoverished also after the war. And they would kind of look after them in certain ways. And there were also these kind of relationships. There are these, I mean, in my first book, I talk about this, but I think it's relevant also for the second book. And this is, there were these dance clubs where there were only, because the army also had segregation, there were only Black men and then German women, white German women. And so that this emerged out of the fact that even though the U.S. was claiming freedom or liberating Germany after the war, there were these contradictions, right? And this idea of democracy in the sense that it also included Jim Crow, and Germans were aware of that. So that occupation then created a different kind of, it nuanced this idea that, you know, like this idea of freedom that was going to emerge, or this idea of democracy that was supposed to emerge, in the sense that the people being occupied could also see the contradictions vis-a-vis Blackness. And I think another important point here is that after the First World War, which Tina Kemp also talks about in her book, Other Germans, the French sent Black troops also to occupy the Rhineland in Germany. But those were seen at that point, that kind of that occupation was seen as a horror. And those troops were accused of raping German women. It was seen as, like, you know, it was like the ultimate humiliation to have these Black troops occupy Germany in that way. But then that shifted with the American Black occupation, in the sense that Blackness was then seen as a kind of possibility. So I think that's when I'm thinking about occupation and Blackness, that's the trajectory I'm thinking about in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is fascinating. It's really fascinating to think about that too, because you bring up this idea of imperialism, but then what happens when, as you said, the occupying troops are actually Black? How does that shift understandings of the U.S. and what does that open up for people? And so in the second part of the book, then you talk about, you give us like this context, I guess, which is the Holocaust, in the memory of the Holocaust in Germany. And, you know, this seems really, really critical because of what it, you know, forecloses and opens up for for immigrants in Germany. And so one of the ways you discuss this memory is through the Holocaust Memorial. And I thought that was really interesting because it links to some of our discussions about memorials and statues in the United States and our current debates around monuments, race, racism, and history in the US. And obviously this occurs elsewhere. And so you also come into these complicated issues through a monument in Germany. And so how does the Holocaust Memorial attend to or not attend to racism and exclusion in Germany?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And obviously, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to fully address it adequately, because I think there's a lot there. I mean, both in terms of how the U.S. does memory politics, how Germany does memory politics, and the relationship between the two. Like, I know that the the lynching memorial in Alabama, I think, was also inspired in part by the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe in Berlin, because the memory culture in the U.S. is strange in the sense that even the, like, if you see the Confederate Army as a defeated army, you don't necessarily see that in the memorials. There's still a memorialization of that history, in a way that also erases the horror, that goes along with it. in the German context, I mean, part of what I think is important to think in terms of memory is the fact that there was this, I mean, mass murder was a central part of what was happening in the Second World War. And it's critical to remember and critical to think about how one should never do that again. But the part of the question is, what is it that should never be done again? And to who, and how does one, is that a particular, or is it universal, or how does one think both historically, but also in the future, and thinking about what one shouldn't do again, and then, or what a nation shouldn't do again, or what a continent, because the murder was happening across Europe. So for me in the book, I'm dealing with the fact that Germany, because it's been able to create these memorials and think about critically about its history, it is taking on this teaching role of also teaching others how to remember, how not to do that again. And in particular, it's how not to do anti-Semitism, I think. But then that sometimes also gets expanded out to thinking about not how to do racism. But for Arab and Turkish Germans in particular, I found that in Germany, the assumption is that they're anti-Semitic, but also that they should also be accountable in some way for this memory, for Holocaust memory, because of a history, because of anti-Semitism in multiple contexts. But then if they are to be accountable, then to what extent can they also participate in this, in the memory politics, but also in talking about democracy after, or talking about inclusion, or talking about freedom on a broad level. What I found in the German context is that when people said that they were experiencing racism, often that was, particularly when Turkish and Arab Germans said that they were experiencing racism, that was seen as anti-Semitic, because the racism that Germans could fully focus on was the racism of the Second World War, was the racism of mass murder, was the racism of genocide. So what for me was important in the book was to link that to, and then blackness then becomes a different kind of possibility, because if you make claims to blackness, or if you make a model of countering these experiences of exclusion that are modeled on other kind on black struggles, then one doesn't get accused of denying the Holocaust in the same way. So in the book, I'm trying to think these histories, these forms of memory, these forms of mobilization together, and then think about, well, if one is particular, perhaps the other can be thought of as more universal. And that, because blackness, as firstly, this occupation or blackness as an occupying form, and then through the claims to blackness, it becomes a different kind of launching pad. But I think that has to, that, I think it does have to be done in relationship to the Holocaust memory, because that's also part of the reference when people are thinking about racism, in, particularly in the German context. But I think that could also be, one has to contend with that also more broadly, I think.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating in the book, because it's something I had never thought about or, you know, considered, where it's like, what is it like then to live in like the afterlife of this other kind of atrocity? And you talk about this in the book, how then the atrocities in the past and, you know, racism and exclusion are not thought to be happening currently. It's something that happened, you know, historically, and that we need to move beyond. And so when these people talk about, you know, racism currently, it like disrupts these ideas of there's not a way to sort of conceptualize it within the idea of the Holocaust memory.
Can I just add something there? I think that's right. But I think that increasingly there are, I mean, people have started to talk about colonialism too, or German colonialism in particular, which was kind of initially not, was getting ignored, right? So the picture has gotten complicated, but still, I mean, I think it needs to get even more complicated in terms of how one thinks about racism now, and who should be able to make claims to thinking about racism and undoing it, you know, and how that, so that, I mean, that's happening through this kind of activism that I was observing, but it's still, I mean, I think there's still a lot more work to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I'm glad you said that, so we can talk about that, like what you were, you know, what you were observing and the young people that you were working with, because you seem to, you know, accompany young people in these different, you know, in different parts of the city. One time, like you go with them to the memorial, you're going with them to different, you know, excursions and whatnot, but you're also with them in these film projects and in the theater. And you examine how, you know, migrants mobilize Blackness to make their claims through theater productions and performances. And I think you're specifically working with the Youth Theater Bureau in Berlin, and you attend their rehearsals. And again, I'm quoting you. You write that the rehearsal space, quote, offered the possibility of to undo fixing, and that Blackness was a possible position from which one could no longer feel stuck. So Blackness seemed to offer, as you were saying, these activists ways to complicate the situation. And so I wondered if you could talk about that. You know, what you saw in these rehearsals and your ideas about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess I went to a performance where I was really struck by how outspoken these young people were in the theater about their own situation in a way that I hadn't, like when I didn't, in that first week I did research in schools, and that kind of possibility or speaking in that way wouldn't really be tolerated. You know, like there was no space for young people in the schools to express how they really felt, you know? But in the theater, I saw like this, that kind of spark and possibility and freedom, and you know, like to say how one really felt and what one wanted to do about it. And so then I said, well, where is this coming from? So then I went to this theater, which then was called Theater Bureau in Berlin, and then now, like they're most known by this, their new name, which is Theater X. And I went into the, and they happened to be doing a play about Blackness, about Black power. And someone said, a young woman said, you know, we need to learn about this. Can you help us? I was like, well, you know, like that's not, you know, like it's not my expertise, but you know, yes, of course, you know, I would be happy. So it was like, so it was my possibility of going into the theater. And then they said that, well, but you can't just observe, you have to also act, you know? So that was a little bit intimidating, but it gave me access to thinking with them about the relationship between Black power and their struggle, and also what they might do about it. And then I also noticed that they didn't have to have all the answers, but they could work out these things in the theater, like they like through improvisational performances, which then became the play that they called Black Hair Germany, that they did at the end of the year. Like, so I it took like about 6 months, like from when I was in that, when they were doing that play to the end, like when they, I think after, actually, I went back to the U.S. and I came back and they then performed the play. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really interesting too. When you talk about the young people and their as you said, like this rehearsal became, I think you said the rehearsal like was the revolution, like that was this critical space of, you know, of them coming to, you know, coming to say whatever they wanted to say. And in the book too, you continually do this. You're careful to distinguish between appropriation and, you know, solidarity and maybe identification. Because we know, as you said, they're taking up these ideas of Black power, they're performing them, they're not people of African descent. And so, you know, and so there's a way in which we know that Blackness can be used in harmful ways, right, that are inappropriated, you know, by many different kinds of people, in ways that are not, it's not necessarily, one might say, not acting in the interests of Black people. And we know that anti-Blackness can be rife in many different locations. And so I wondered if you could talk about then this distinction that you make between like appropriation and the solidarity, which I think is what you were seeing with your interlocutors.
yeah, I mean, I think appropriation goes with like sort of making, like profiting from other people's struggle, or, you know, like profiting from Black struggle without caring or about Black people, you know, or performing, you know, that in itself becomes a form of anti-Blackness, I think. Some of the people, there were Black people of Black African descent in the theater as well. They weren't the majority. Like one of the main actors was from West Africa. And what struck me, you know, is that he came not necessarily thinking, you know, it wasn't clear to me the extent to which he thought of himself as Black, but then Blackness, even for him, became an important way of articulating any kind of possibility, right? Because for him, like he didn't even have a, you know, he came to Germany without any kind of status, right? He had so he was in danger of being deported, but then the theater became like, they were able to make claims about he became an actor. And then because he was an actor, the theater advocated for him to get the right to stay in Berlin. And then ultimately he could stay in Germany without having to do these other kinds of, without having to perform the other kinds of expectations, which I talked about in the first book, like of the hypersexual performance, which would then allow him to get married to someone who then could give him a status. Or he talked about in a film that he made later, having a German baby, which then would give him some sort of marginal status. But it was actually Blackness that made this performance of Blackness, this rehearsal of Blackness, and in the theater and then in everyday life, that allowed him to find a way to manage his life in Germany and stay in Germany and claim right to that, possibility. Yeah. So can you just remind me of the question?
Oh yeah. It was between the difference between appropriation and maybe solidarity.
So I think that, it probably can't be absolute. Like there could be, you know, and there were moments of what one might see as anti-Blackness, even in these kinds of spaces, right? Or there are ways in which Black people might not feel completely comfortable, at least, you know. But I think that attending to those tensions is critical to avoiding the risks, dangers, injuries of appropriation. So that's the kind of, and that's the kind of, so I the thing that I mean, the term that I like even more than solidarity, because I mean, at one point in the book, I talk about like people claim solidarity, but actually there's still hierarchy often in these claims of solidarity, because the people saying that, well, we're in solidarity with you. There's like, there's the us who's in solidarity, who then still maintain our position of hierarchy, you know, of being on top or kind of determining what the next move should be. So, I mean, the term that I like most is mutual struggle. So when that struggle is thought of as mutual, then it shifts from, at least it lessens the risk of appropriation and moves more towards a kind of mutual possibility into which one is then also accountable to Black people, to Blackness, to, you know, the histories of slavery, you know, I think. And not only in the US, but also in Europe, which people often forget, right? Slavery is not just an American thing, right? It's even chattel slavery, right? It relies on these dynamics between, you know, the other people have talked about between the Caribbean, the U.S., in Europe and Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you just talked about how one of your interlocutors, I think, what's his name, Mamadou, in the book, where he makes a film. And that was another aspect of cultural production that you were looking at in the book. And you had this project, or you were part of this project called Filming the Future from Berlin. And so I had the privilege of being your colleague at Michigan. And so I also remember you talking about this, like filming the future, I think from Detroit. Yes. And so, you know, I think you've done this project in different places. And I wondered if you could talk about this project. I remember briefly talking with you about it in Michigan, and it sounded absolutely fascinating. And so I wondered if you could talk about Filming the Future, you know, how it's structured. And because I think you're actually teaching people how to make a film. And I think you've done this in the classroom. You've done it in Germany, in the United States. I mean, this is amazing. And so I wondered if you could just tell us about this project. And you talk about it in the book.
Yeah. I mean, the project was actually inspired the same time I was doing research for the book, I worked with the theater act, and there was this other theater called Ballhaus Naunienstrasse, which was it used to be a ballroom that was turned into a theater. It was on this street called Naunienstrasse. Strasse means street. So it was another theater where they had a progressive Turkish German director. Now it's moved. It's become like mostly a black, you know, a POC, black, they, I guess a BIPOC, BPOC theater. Where they had this project called Academy of the Autodidacts. So like the Academy of people teaching themselves, basically, you know. And they had this film project called News from the Neighborhood, where they would make films like once a month about, they would pick a topic. One time it was on blackness. One time it was on, there were these murder, series of neo-Nazi murders where they killed people, Turkish Germans mostly, over a decade, and one Greek person, a Greek German person, and a police officer. But even though these murders had been perpetrated by neo-Nazis, they called it the Döner Mafia. Like Döner is this sandwich that Turkish German shops sell. They accused the people who are the victims of neo-Nazi violence of committing murders against themselves. You know, that was like one of the topics. So, and then they would, as part of that film project, there would be two mentors, and then they would show the films at the end of the month, and the theater was always packed. So I participated in that a number of times as I was doing the research for this book. And I was really inspired by that model as a way of thinking about the future of the city and also bringing voices that are not usually heard into the discussion about how that future might be actualized. And so this project, which I began in Detroit with a theater with a filmmaker from Berlin in 2014. We wanted to do the same kind of thing in Detroit where we would make it. Then it was over 3 weeks, and it would include people from Detroit and people from the University of Michigan making films about the future of the city, thinking about Detroit as a place in which is not, like, people don't think of Detroit as a valuable place from which to imagine the future often, but I think it's critical, right? If I'm thinking about, the relationship to this book is Detroit is also an 80% black city. But to think about the future from the perspective of the people who are, you know, some of the most marginalized is critical to thinking about any kind of viable future for, you know, at all, I think. And so we, in that project we make, and which is also related to the project in Berlin, Filming the Future from Berlin, which was 2015, was the so-called summer migration in Germany when there were a million Syrian refugees came to Berlin. And in Berlin in that first iteration, the summer of 2015, also with the filmmaker from Berlin, with whom I began the Detroit project, Ayla Gottschlisch, and Savannah Santamaria was also one of the filmmakers who's been working with me on this for a while, in addition to Theater X, where we did the first project in Berlin. The mostly Syrian people had just come to Germany or had been there for, you know, a short period of time, then also made films about the future of the city from their perspective. We call it non-citizen perspectives on the future of the city. And then later, we made those films in which people would ask their own research question, and then they would then make the film about that question. And then we screened them in Detroit or Berlin, and then most recently in Philadelphia. And so we've been doing that since, 2014, 2015 in Berlin, and then 2022 in Philadelphia. Now we're thinking about how to exhibit those films more broadly as a broader take on the future of the city from non-citizen, from Black perspectives, particularly these post-industrial cities where it's not clear how one should imagine the future, and where the non-citizen or African perspective is not normally thought about. So that Mamadou in the book made a film about his experience of coming to Germany. And then given that when he came, I talked about this earlier, but when he came, people kept saying, he asked me this too in the theater, how am I going to stay here? I don't have a status. I don't have a legal status. And people kept saying, well, you can either get married to a German woman or have a baby. Like, those are the two main ways that we're telling him to stay. And he said, well, I don't want to do that. I want to, I'm not ready to have a baby. I don't want to get married. Because he could see the problems with that too, right? That creates that he wouldn't be able to really be who he wanted to be in that condition. So he said his solution to the film, which was called Change the System, so that was the... So we've been doing for a while, almost every summer now in Berlin and then in Detroit as well. And then once in Philadelphia.
Yeah. I liked, your descriptions of the films in the book because they were very, poignant, very critical. And then you also talk about sometimes the responses that they elicit from the audience. That was a great section of the book. So one of the reasons I was interested in your book is because I'm working on a project about how Afro-Brazilians take up African-American history and culture. And so I am really interested in these transnational flows of Blackness. And I think that they're really important because they carry these unforeseen modes of power that can be leveraged by others that one would not possibly previously have thought of. And so you talk about how, Blackness opens up spaces for non-Black and Black people in Germany to find expression. And of course, you give us this like critical context in which sort of Blackness makes this possible. And so I wondered what you thought about like the particularity of African-American Blackness. And is there something about African-American Blackness that lends itself to universality, or is it also Blackness beyond the United States? So I just wanted to know what you thought about that. And then, what are the implications that you see of your argument, and, what do you want people to take from it?
Yeah, this idea that when one talks about Blackness or universal or global Blackness, that one's only talking about American Blackness often leads, in some contexts, that leads to people to dismiss it. They say, well, this is not, has nothing to do with us. Particularly people critiquing the use or invocation of Blackness, I guess, are often doing that. And then it becomes like for scholars writing about Blackness in other contexts, or artists trying to talk about Blackness in other contexts, or activists trying to articulate Blackness in other contexts, it makes the struggle that much harder. Like if it's seen as only American, right? So I think that even what people perceive as American Blackness is already transnational. Like hip hop is not just American, right? It relies on the, like Caribbean sound systems. Brazil is a. You can say much more about the importance of Blackness in Brazil, but it's like that has a huge global impact as well. So I think that there are a lot of American, because obviously the way American media circulates and also it kind of rebrands or repackages or appears to be only American, but in fact, I think it's already a transnational form that creates a transnational kind of possibility. So I think it should be taken seriously, and it should also then be thought of, but in being taken seriously, it also like its transnational dimensions should also be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And so I think that is the question about the book. And so we usually end the interviews with these questions of the future. And so what you're working on next, do you have any upcoming projects or, any other kinds of activities that are on the horizon now that the book Blackness as a Universal Claim is out in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I do have a few projects. Like, one is the thinking about how to circulate these films and thinking about, like, I've been talking about, like, starting doing a book, kind of a multimodal book. So it's not really a book, but it's, we'll still call it a book. I mean, like, because it would work through the book publishing system. But to think about publishing, how to circulate these films and how to get other people to participate, and also going to other cities, like perhaps Johannesburg and South Africa, New York City, you know, Mumbai in India, to think about like the connections between these cities and connections between futures, and if there's a way of connecting futures or linking people transnationally to think of collectively about futures, people who aren't normally consulted when policymakers or urban planners are thinking about the city or the future of the city. And then the other project that I've been working on a lot recently is this one that is on Detroit, which the central question is how does white space get produced in a black city? And thinking about the implications of that kind of production on blackness and a black city, and then on black possibility. But then also thinking of Detroit as a space from which one should, like a critical space from which one should imagine the future, and that kind of future could be applicable then also in other places.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that really sounds fascinating, and wish you the best as you pursue these projects. I think both of those projects sound so rich. And I think the film project is interesting in that. I 100% agree. As I was reading the book, I thought, oh, I would love to see these films. And so I know that there will be an audience waiting to watch them. So that sounds wonderful. So thank you so much for sharing the book with us. I have been speaking with Damani Partridge, the author of Blackness as a Universal Claim, Holocaust Heritage, Non-Citizen Futures, and Black Power in Berlin, published by the University of California Press. Thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for your questions as well, and inviting me to this conversation.